Thanks for joining us on the J-Talk podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell with Johnny Nicol. As John Steele did on last week's episode of Extra Time, we wanted to begin this podcast by remembering the life and career of Masato Kudo, the former Japan international who passed away on Friday after complications following brain surgery. Kudo rose to prominence and was both a J2 and J1 champion, amongst other honours, with Kashiwa, and then had spells with Vancouver, Hiroshima, Yamaguchi, Brisbane, and Miyazaki, for whom he scored 3 goals in 21 J3 appearances this season before entering hospital in early October. Johnny, this is truly devastating news, and our thoughts go out to all of Kudo's former colleagues, and in particular, of course, his wife and a young daughter.
Yeah, absolutely, Ben. It's the kind of thing that puts everything in perspective. You know, I'm Kudo as a player. Obviously, I've never played for one of the teams I support, but he's a Japan international. He's obviously very, very well liked and very well respected throughout the Japanese footballing community. And yeah, when I saw he'd gone into intensive care, it didn't really dawn on me the kind of enormity or the situation. But then, yeah, 24 hours later, it was announced he was gone. And I just, yeah, I couldn't believe it. I think, you know, he's 32, which is getting close to being a veteran in footballing terms. But in terms of life, he's still a very, very, very young man with, as you mentioned, a wife and young child. I can't begin to imagine what they're going through. So, yeah, I mean, for myself, and I think, yeah, everyone in the kind of J-Talk community, I think our hearts go out to them, don't they?
Yeah, most definitely. A terrific player. Of course, as I said, yeah, a key part of the J1 champion Kashiwa team in 2011. And yeah, just a terrific forward, very intelligent player. And yeah, such a shame, obviously, that his life has been taken at such a young age. And by all accounts, yeah, a wonderful person and teammate as well. And yeah, taken far too soon. Our regularly scheduled podcast with guest Dan Orlowitz follows, but Kudo will remain firmly in our thoughts. Rest in peace, Masato Kudo.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk podcast. Ben Maxwell and Johnny Nicol with you. Johnny, thanks for pinch hitting for Sam this week. Mr. Robson is busy doing repairs to the Shimizu bandwagon that broke an axle and punctured 2 tyres running off the road in a second half stoppage time in the Shizuoka Derby on Saturday evening.
Hi, Ben. It's good to be back so soon after my last appearance, but I'm feeling a touch nervous because we've got a guest on this week with me co-hosting, and the guest we have on is the person who was first on the pod the first time I listened. It was you and this gentleman that were on talking together. So a bit of nostalgia, a bit of nerves, but I'm glad to be here. So how are you doing, Ben?
I'm good, thank you, Johnny. Yes, it's great. Yeah, 2 greats of the J-Talk podcast family are coming together finally. The people have been waiting for it, and yes, here it is on episode 438, listeners. So we've teased the Shizuoka Derby off the top there. It was a massive game in the relegation dogfight, and Johnny and I will cover that in part 2 of this episode, while we'll also hand out some more Player of the Season silverware at the end of the podcast. But joining us off the top to chat about the other big game from Saturday, the Levain Cup final at the National Stadium that saw Hiroshima triumph at the death over Cerezo Osaka, it's Dan Orlowitz from the Japan Times. Dan, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
I'm good. Good to talk to you as always, Ben. Good to talk to you for the first time, Johnny. It's always nice to connect with our community, and we don't always have the opportunity to do so. So that makes these opportunities all the much more important.
Absolutely. All right. So, Dan, Johnny and I did a quick piece at the start of the episode in remembrance of Masato Kudo. You had a piece in the Japan Times about, the tragic story of Kudo's passing. And I mean, it's really hit the Japanese footballing community hard, hasn't it?
It has. It's a tragedy. I just can't really come up with too many words, which is something a sentiment that's been echoed across the community. I did a lot of photography work during his prime at Kashua Reysol, so I got to shoot a number of Kudo goals in the league, in the J League Cup. I got to see him raise several trophies, and he was a player with such a bright future, and it's really just horrible to see it end like this.
Dan, Johnny and I were talking in the green room, and we weren't sure whether we were going to bring this up or not, but the fact that Miyazaki actually played their game over the weekend, were you surprised that that took place? And is it your understanding that were they given an option to not play, or is it simply too late in the J3 season that all the fixtures have to basically get played when they're supposed to?
I do think that given the challenges of the J3 schedule, given that they do have to wrap up the J League season before the World Cup starts, I think it's unfortunate that they probably didn't have much of a choice. I'm not personally aware of whether the club had a choice to postpone or not, but I imagine that it's not going to hurt any less. And given the logistics, and especially with the clubs that have much smaller budgets for travel and all that, I think they just had to do it. And it's unfortunate that the players had to be put in that situation, but I think that they did as best as they could, and that's true of everyone, because I think it's the loss, not just obviously for Miyazaki, but for the community as a whole.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to stir up any controversy there by even bringing up the topic. But obviously the Miyazaki players will have played with very, very heavy hearts indeed over the weekend, as did Sanfrecce Hiroshima at the National Stadium, Dan. And what a difference a week makes for Sanfrecce. Of course, they were stunned in the Emperor's Cup final on penalties by J2 Kofu last Sunday, and they were just minutes away from a second final defeat in a week when they entered second half stoppage time a goal down to Cerezo Osaka, only for Cypriot striker Pieros Sotiriou to score twice deep into added time. And well, this must have been for the second week in a row a sports writer's worst nightmare. I'm sure your match report was the three quarters done when the game entered second half stoppage time on Saturday.
Yes, it was even in a way almost worse than the Emperor's Cup final, because at least when there's a late equalizer, at least you're going into extra time. You have time to write and to rewrite if necessary, and there's a bit of a buffer there. But two goals to end the game in stoppage time, that hurts. I did get my report out somewhat late-ish in the evening, but I also had the benefit of not having to write for print. And when you are writing for print, that can get pretty ugly. And the game itself was pretty ugly, but wow, what a finish.
Most definitely. I mean, it promised a lot, Johnny. The team's obviously third and fourth in the league. Coming in, Hiroshima third, of course, 4 points ahead of Cerezo in the J1 table. Hiroshima looking to shake off the disappointment from last Sunday, and Cerezo obviously looking to go one better than their, frankly, really poor appearance in the final last season. But, I guess you could argue that the magnitude of the stage got to both teams throughout the course of this game. It wasn't maybe the spectacle we were hoping for.
Yeah, I think that there might be a few reasons for that. You mentioned Sanfrecce are third, Cerezo are fourth. There's probably a bit of cancelling each other out. They're both quite good, quite evenly matched teams. And then, again, you mentioned Cerezo played very poorly last season in the cup final. Hiroshima played very poorly 1 week ago in a cup final. So there's two teams with not particularly great recent records in playing in these kind of games. And throw into the fact Cerezo hadn't played for quite a bit of time, and Sanfrecce's only recent game was a very chastening one. And yeah, maybe on this big stage, it's probably no surprise that things were a bit cagey early on, and maybe only lit up late on, as Dan mentioned.
Well, yeah, so the first half basically just happened. I think we can, consign that to history and, try and forget it as quickly as possible. And I guess it would have been, not for Cerezo supporters, obviously, it would have been a bit of a shame if the only goal of the game had have been as a result, a direct result of Sanfrecce captain Shaw Sasaki's mistake 8 minutes into the second half, Dan, when he underhit a back pass, or he just simply didn't see Mutsuki Kato lurking in the area. Kato very gratefully accepted the gift, rounded Keisuke Osako, and falling off balance, did well to slot the ball into an empty net, but only for VAR to come to Sanfrecce's rescue on a couple of occasions. The first with about 15 minutes to go, and it's that time for the jingle, I think, gentlemen. So with about 15 minutes left, a ball was cleared out of the Hiroshima box. The Cerezo defender, Matej Jonić, clashed with Sanfrecce striker, Nassim Ben Khalifa, and basically body slammed him to the floor. When both players got to their feet, Jonić basically tried to nudge Ben Khalifa away, if I'm being nice, but unfortunately for Jonić, his arm, as he extended it, made a very, very slight contact with Ben Khalifa's cheek. Whether that was enough to cause him to fall to the floor in a heap or not, Dan, I don't know, but Ben Khalifa, I guess he won that particular battle at the end of the day with Jonić, with the referee summoned to the monitor and ultimately changing his yellow card into a red. I guess it's obviously something that you don't like to see, but what did you think of the incident, and did VAR ultimately get this right, or was this really, really harsh on Cerezo?
I think that there was a bit handbaggy. I think it was a dumb action to take. If you're on the pitch when you're retaliating like that, and that was, I think, the bulk of this red card, was the fact that it was a retaliation. If you get caught, then you go into the naughty bin. And I think that that's what happened here, and you just can't do it. That's maybe a little harsh, but whenever you strike out at an opposing player like that, you're taking a really big risk. And I think that with VAR in play, which isn't something that clubs necessarily had to deal with in the group stage, that there's all the more chance that the referee will say, well, was there something? Was there? And he'll check with the sideline judges, and they'll get the call from the room. So it was dumb, and I think that you can't really fault the decision.
Dan, had there been any build up to that? Because I only managed to catch the highlights, but it seemed like, just watching the highlights, maybe the Ben Khalifa and Jonić had been going at it all game. Had anything particularly led up to that incident?
Yeah, I didn't see that. There wasn't anything massive between the two, but the game was getting very chippy. There was a sequence a minute or so after the red card where there was a collision. I think it was towards the Cerezo end on the right side, and I very distinctly remember the referee calling over both captains and having a very strong word with them. And you couldn't really see what he was saying, but I'm sure it was something like, knock this off right now and make sure that your teammates know to do so. So it was, I think, with 10 minutes left in the game, very tight game overall. It was just the nature of how the two teams were going at it.
So, Johnny, I wouldn't say that Jonić punched Ben Khalifa, but his clenched fist made contact with Ben Khalifa's cheek. So in some respects, I guess he has. But I mean, it wasn't obviously a jab or a roundhouse to make contact with Ben Khalifa. Again, myself, I've only seen the highlights as well, but it does look, as Dan says, if you're if you get caught, then you've got to pay the penalty. But I mean, it's it's one of those where you, I mean, you obviously hate to see it and potentially spoil Cerezo's occasion. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, do you think Jonic has got too much to complain about?
I think the look on Jonic's face when the referee went over and gave him a red card and the fact he walked straight off, he knew he'd done something wrong. It's like, so where do you draw the line? He's got a clenched fist well away from his body that hits an opponent in the face. It's not going to knock out anyone, but like, how does he explain why is it there? He's obviously thought about it. He's not necessarily trying to seriously injure an opponent, but he's trying to make a point, and he's done something that's illegal. So it's not the worst thing that someone's ever been red carded for in a football game. I think there was a video doing the rounds on Twitter of an early round of the Scottish Cup, and someone did much, much worse to get a red card. But I think ultimately it's the right decision. For me, I was actually wondering, because the referee's position, he must see what happens. And he gives Jonic a yellow card and then goes to VAR, which I wonder is a if that's a reaction to, if I can shoehorn a Gamba reference in here, that the opening day of the season with Patrick being given a red card, and because it was technically foul play, they couldn't rescind the red card if they've been told to go on the lighter side, go for the yellow and then upgrade to a red. I wonder if that might be kind of what the kind of line they've gone down.
I can speak to that to some extent, because I haven't attended the last couple JFA referee briefings, but there were some incidents over the last couple of seasons where you had the J League's disciplinary committee going back to retroactively suspend players where there was something that happened in terms of physical aggression that maybe the referee didn't see or only gave a yellow to. I think one of Leandro's punch elbow things. Ben,
which one?
Was
which
on
one?
There. Exactly. Which one? And I think that there's once like a decision can be. So what it is that a decision can be appealed or a decision can be reviewed, but a non-decision once play resumes is harder to review, unless I believe that's how it is. So if Jonic didn't get a card at all and play resumes, they can't go back and retroactively give him a yellow or a red. I'm not going to speak on that with 100% authority. I'm just pretty sure that that's the line of thinking. I mean, if you see the play and you think it's a yellow, it's at least a yellow, you can give the yellow, and then during that time, if VAR is looking at it, they have time to say, well, no, maybe this should be more. You should have a second look.
I think that kind of followed on from, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, there was a Kyoto game. I think it was Kyoto-Nagoya, and it looked like the most obvious penalty in the history of football, but the ref didn't give it, and they took forever to take to check it on VAR. So I think it was just those two incidents in my head that kind of put that together. I don't know. I think that, thanks for that, Dan, because you've added more clarity than I had, but that's just where I was coming from.
Well, I actually wonder, Johnny, whether the yellow card was for the body slam rather than the push-off with the arm. Because, I mean, if the referee had have seen Jonic's arm make contact with Ben Khalifa's face, then surely it would have been a straight red to begin with. But, yeah, maybe you're right. If they can't walk back a red card, I suppose. But, so that was the Cerezo down to 10 men with about 15 minutes to go. Then in between Kato's goal and the red card, there were good saves at either end. 5 minutes after Kato's goal, Keisuke Osako made a point blank save from Seiya Maekuma's blast, and then just past the hour, Kim Jin-hyun made a low save to keep out a Ben Khalifa header. And then as the game entered second half stoppage time, Dan's match report was three quarters written, and he was itching to press send. But wait, there's more. Yes, and VAR came to Hiroshima's rescue again in the 92nd minute when Makoto Mitsuta swung in a corner. A Ben Khalifa header hit Koji Toriumi's raised arm. And after VAR called the referee over, there was only ever going to be one outcome. A penalty to Hiroshima was the decision. And finally, in the 96th minute, Sotiriu sent Kim the wrong way from the spot. We've still got the VAR jingle playing in the background. I don't think anybody can have too many complaints, most especially Toriumi, Johnny. That was, as point blank as it can be.
Yeah, I don't know what's his hand doing there. It's like Jonic with his clenched fist in Ben Khalifa's face. You're presented with that on a VAR screen. My hand was up, the ball's hit my hand, even if it's come from really close by. I think if he's got his hands by his side or in a more natural position, then he could get away with it. But with his hand up like that, yeah, there's no two ways about it. It seems harsh in Sarasor because you've got two of these kind of decisions go against him so quickly, but... You know, that's the way the cookie crumbles sometimes in a cup final.
I wanted to add just on how close a game this was. And Ben, you mentioned Kim Jin-hyun, the J-League's chairman, Yoshikazu Nonomura, was telling us after the game that Kim was very much in the running for MVP. That was it was only in the last... obviously a few minutes of stoppage time that the decision was changed. But I can actually sort of speak to that. I remember last year or 2 years ago, I was selected to vote on the MVP for the Levain Cup, and they give you a ballot, and about 10 minutes before the final whistle, they come around and they collect the paper. And a lot, it really goes to show that a lot can happen in those 10 minutes.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, I don't know whether Toriumi thought he was playing wide receiver for the Philadelphia Eagles or not, Dan. But, yes, he was rightly punished for his raised arm in the box. So, Toriumi, sending Kim the wrong way. And then in the 101st minute, Mitsuta swung in another corner with Toriumi hooking in a tremendous volley past a helpless Kim Jin-hyun. Dan, I don't know what your view was like from the press seats at the National Stadium, but from the, obviously a number of replays of this goal, from the side angle, it looked like the ball might have skimmed off Hayato Araki's head and gone in off Sotiriu's thigh. But, I mean, the angle behind the goal, it does the strike justice. I mean, he does absolutely superbly. It's such a precise concentration to volley the ball, literally just maybe he does skim off Araki's head. But, yeah, to control his volley, get it on target, and most importantly, keep it down, it's a remarkable finish.
You could have held a gun to my head at the time, and I would not have been able to tell you which part of his body hit that ball in. I mean, that also has to do with the fact that the press seats are closer to Mars than they are to the pitch. But I mean, I did look at I've looked at the same replay. You've seen it. Just what a hit! Like even watching the replay, you still sort of can't tell how he got the power and control behind it, which makes it all the much more a remarkable goal, in my opinion.
Yeah, came in with a good reputation, obviously, Johnny, but hasn't had too many chances to prove what he can do to the Hiroshima faithful and the wider J-League community as well. I mean, he's only made 6 league appearances and 3 starts since he signed in August, and his only league goal was coincidentally against Cerezo Osaka, the same opponents from Saturday in match day 27. But I mean, that's just a terrific strike, and you could see what it meant to him. His shirt was straight off, and ran for the second time in 5 minutes, ran to celebrate with the Hiroshima supporters.
Yeah, I think it was quite telling that after the Emperor's Cup final, Douglas Vieira was nowhere to be seen. Because, I mean, to be fair to him, I think when he joined Sanfrecce in 2019, I didn't think he was really the answer. Now in 2022, approaching 35, he's definitely not the answer. I think Sotiriu is absolutely the future. I'm not sure if Sanfrecce just had the chance to buy him and they've brought him in. Because I think it's worth mentioning that the summer transfer window was at its regular time this year, but the J-League's almost been kind of shunted forward. So players coming in the summer didn't really have a whole lot of time to make an impact. So I think Sotiriu, this period of time will be more gearing him up for next season, where I'm sure he'll be leading the line, and probably Ben Khalifa will be there as well. But yeah, everything Dan said and you said about the finish, it's like there's the sound, there's what you expect to happen, there's the speed the ball goes off. None of it kind of adds up. You just sometimes you'll see in the highlights, they'll just play the same goal again and again. It's like, yeah, I've got it. But this one, you very much needed to see all the angles. And yeah, I mean, it was a brilliant week for Corfu last week, but you did feel for the big travelling Hiroshima support. And I'm glad for the season they've had. It's tough for Cerezo to take, but I think for the way they've bounced back, like Skibba said, coming in, that this year was a season about like kind of stopping the rot, rebuilding, and then next year they're going to kick on. But yeah, this year he's already got one trophy, one cup final, and third place. And yeah, but both Zamfretti and Cerezo are good, kind of general good stories this year, moving up from 11th and 12th last year. So yeah, fantastic scenes for them. Tough luck for Cerezo, and maybe not the greatest of finals, but I think there's brighter days around the corner for both of these clubs.
Yeah, very well said. And yeah, I concur. It's great for Hiroshima to finish off. Well, not quite finish off, because they're obviously still hoping to finish third. But yeah, to get some silverware in the cabinet, and yeah, just put a real emphasis on Michael Skibba's first season, Dan, because yeah, he's taken them from literally second from bottom after five match days right up into the J1 title race. And yeah, if they had have lost the two finals in a week, well, I'm sure they would have picked themselves up for next Saturday's league fixture. But yeah, this is just I'm sure giving everyone a massive buzz around the place, because yeah, it's their first ever Levain Cup title, and you could see how much it meant to them. And obviously with the emotion so high after the passing of Masato Kudo, it was a huge outpouring of emotion from the players and their staff at the full-time whistle when it finally rang.
And not just their first ever Levain Cup title, but their first ever cup title as a professional club. Obviously, I think Zamfretti won three Emperor's Cups as Mazda or whatever that predecessor was in the 60s. But since they became Zamfretti Hiroshima, I think including the last Sunday's Emperor's Cup, eight runner-up finishes in cup finals. So that's a big monkey to have on your back. And I think that for them to finally have that championship ceremony, to finally lift that trophy, was massive for the club, as you say, for Kudo. Just seeing the banners with the messages for him, seeing just walking to the stadium and seeing the number of Hiroshima fans who are wearing Kudo uniforms. This is a player, you know, who was only there 2 years, and not necessarily his peak time, but for them to have such an attachment to him, obviously it meant so much to his teammates. On Skipe, I do want to point out sort of the difference between how he and Rene Weiler managed, the former Kashima manager. Mm-hmm. And I think that it sort of shows you that the big difference between having a club that is behind you and supports what you're doing, even if it is sort of a rebuilding year, and having a club that maybe isn't as patient as it should be. Yeah, that's, we've seen lots of clubs in the J League that haven't had that patience. I think Vissel Kobe can be fairly described like that. And then you have clubs that have had that patience, like Yokohama F. Marinos and Ange Postecoglou in the 2018 season. And it really does show you that when you have the right foreign manager, even though the first year may be a rebuilding year, even though there are challenges when it comes to communication and building that culture, if you stick with it, they will get you there.
Yeah, that's very well said, Dan. And yeah, Michael Skibba, this entire season has been absolutely superb from him. And yeah, his players, as Johnny said, working their way up from 11th in the table, and as I said, second from bottom after five match days, they've done absolutely tremendously. And yeah, Dan, you mentioned that their first ever cup. Well, all it took was Sam to mention that on the last week's episode, and wouldn't you know it, the J-Talk reverse jinx was in full effect. So yes, yeah, Sam mentions it, and voila, curse is lifted on Saturday. So you're welcome, Sanfrecce supporters. Yeah, for the Cerezo faithful, obviously a very hard one to take so late on in the game, especially when, yeah, a couple of VAR decisions went against them. And, well, yeah, I'm not sure there's too much we can say to sugarcoat Saturday for them, as it's their second straight Levain Cup final defeat. But they do still have an outside chance of finishing third in the league. And, of course, that will get an ACL playoff berth if Urawa don't win the ACL final in late February next year. Just very quickly, Hiroshima play Sapporo at home and Tosu away in the final two match days. Cerezo are away at Kyoto on Saturday and then home against Nagoya in the final round of the season. So, Dan, just before we let you go, we've got, yes, the Shizuoka Derby to talk about next, and then Player of the Season awards to hand out. But before we let you go, we wanted to ask you something about both of those particular topics. So, Johnny, you were curious to get Dan's thoughts on a recent news story surrounding Jubilo Iwata.
Yeah, so I know you've been covering this on Twitter, Dan, about Jubilo Iwata have been handed a two-window transfer ban, I believe, for what's been deemed to be an illegal transfer involving the Colombian forward Fabian Gonzalez. But Ben and I were kind of talking about it. We know bits and pieces, but we thought you were maybe the perfect person to explain it more in detail. So could you tell us a bit more about that?
Okay, well, so what allegedly happened, or what FIFA has, what FIFA's dispute arbitration or dispute resolution committee, I believe it's called, has ruled, is that Jubilo in January 2021 they signed Fabian Gonzalez, and apparently he had already signed a contract with a Thai club. I don't know who the Thai club is. It's weird because Jubilo just referred to it as a Thai club. I'm sure someone out there has a better idea of the identity of that club. But allegedly he had agreed to personal terms, and then he broke their contract and signed with Jubilo. And so the punishment handed down by FIFA is that Jubilo have to pay the Thai club $50,000. And he's been given a 4-month suspension, 4.5-month suspension. And the club has been totally banned from signing new players for two transfer windows. So they've agreed, they basically said that they'll pay the fine together with Gonzalez. And as far as everything else, they're appealing to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. So, as for when this ban will take effect, I assume that it will sort of not until the CAS delivers its ruling, and I don't know when that will be. So as far as what will happen to them this winter, that's a very good question. They're allowed to sign players who are coming back from loan, and they're allowed to sign players coming up from the academy. And that's if this transfer ban goes into effect. But that's really it.
Thanks very much for that, Dan. I know that they had a pre-contract with a young forward called Shu Moroka from Tokyo International University. And I believe that he's been told to look for a new club because they can't actually go ahead and sign him. Although they have promoted a second grade high schooler, Keita Goto. And I believe it was also being reported in Japanese kind of media circles about Kenyu Sugimoto, who I doubt they would actually want to keep on for next season anyway, but he has to go back to his parent club, Urawa. And as you mentioned, they've got players out on loan, but just kind of looking through them, there's 7 players out on loan, but I think only the defender, Kaito Suzuki at Tochigi, he's a Japan youth international. He's the only one that really looks like he could come back in and sort of feature regularly in the first team. I know Sam's friend Yutaro Hakamata has been scoring a few goals for Omiya, so I don't know if he could maybe convert to a centre forward, because if Gonzalez is a forward and he's suspended, Sugimoto has to go back, and Moroka was a forward as well, so filling that centre forward role is going to be quite a challenge next season if they're not allowed to sign players this winter. I don't know how quickly the Court of Arbitration for Sport ruling will come back, but I think it's it's at least going to have some detrimental effect to them going into the winter by the looks of things, I think.
Just quickly, Johnny, on Hakamato, is he scoring goals into his own net or into opponents' nets these days?
No, he had quite a fine finish at the weekend at 2 yards out. It was difficult to keep down, but he tucked it in a 3-all draw with Nagasaki. I'm not sure how many goals. I've got a feeling he scored about 3 goals in a very short space of time for Omiya. So, and he's keeping them out of his own net. So maybe he's the answer to Jubilo centre forward woes.
Well, there you go. There you go. Pigs do indeed fly. All right. And so, Dan, yeah, the last bit of business we've got to ask of you is basically, I think you've just got to rubber stamp something for us. Yeah, we've been doing our players of the season polls, of course, and the FC Tokyo poll was the first cab off the rank this past week. 15 of our patrons voted in it. The three choices were Adailton, Jakub Slovic, and the rookie sensation, or maybe not quite as sensational as we all hoped, Kuryu Matsuki. I actually did a typo typing out the options in the poll, and midfielder slash forward turned into midfield question mark forward, Adailton. But yeah, I guess he kind of flits between the two roles, doesn't he? And we're not really sure where he fits in, but he looks like he's going to be a two-time defending champion of the FC Tokyo Player of the Season poll. He was the runaway winner for our patrons. Would he also get your vote?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. He's brought a real dynamism to Tokyo's attack, and I like him because he's got all the skills and flair and ability of Leandro without any of the temper. And I do wish that we've had a bit more of that this season, but no, it's I think he's a totally worthy pick to be Tokyo's MVP.
Yeah, fair enough. I concur. And yet, two-thirds of the 15 votes counted were for Adailton. There's also a question from Alex Bishop on Keigo Higashi, Dan. But yeah, your feelings as well as mine about Higashi are well and truly known. So I might save that one for later and just ask Johnny about that. But yeah, Higashi. Yeah, Alex trying to sneak him into the player of the season poll, but under my watch that was never going to happen. But you've obviously had a couple of busy weekends. The first one at the Nissan Stadium for the Emperor's Cup final, and then last Saturday the Levain Cup final. Yeah, definitely drama at the tail end of both games, and great to have you on the podcast again. Just before we let go, one final thing. F. Marino is going to hold on and win the league, do you think?
Oh, Christ almighty.
just an easy one to say.
Speaking of games that will be absolute nightmares for anyone writing on deadline, and this is sort of when I'm... Well, this is where I'm sort of grateful that our paper no longer has a Sunday edition, so I don't quite have to panic about that. I don't know. It's gonna be close. I think it could very well come down to round 34. I think that after these last two games, Marinos have had a couple of weeks to sit down and take a deep breath. I remember being pitch side in 2013 when all they needed was that win over Albirex Niigata, and it would have been theirs. And that didn't happen. And once that didn't happen, once they lost that game, you could just feel it in the air that they were never going to beat. I mean, they could have still won the title with a win over Kawasaki in the season finale, but you just felt that they couldn't do it. And if you're asking me if I feel that now, I don't know, but I do think that they, if they don't win on Saturday, it's gonna be really, really tough. I just, you need to get that momentum back, even if it's coming down to the pressure of a season finale win, or of needing a season finale win. You can't go into that coming off a draw. I think you need that win. You need the players to be confident.
All right, then. Well, yeah, hopefully we've been hospitable hosts on your return to the podcast, Dan, but hopefully my Houston Astros won't be as hospitable to your Philadelphia Phillies when the World Series gets going on Friday US time, Saturday morning Japan time. We weren't able to thresh out a wager before you popped on the podcast. Maybe some of the listeners can suggest a friendly bet between the two of us on the outcome of the series. Drop it in the comments to this episode or mention us both on Twitter with your ideas. But yeah, may the best team win, mate.
Absolutely. No, it's pretty cool to be back, and it's a good time to be a Philly sports fan. Phillies in the World Series, Philadelphia Union in the MLS Eastern Conference Final, Eagles undefeated, Flyers have a winning record, Sixers exist. it's good times to be a 5 for 5 city.
Excellent stuff, mate. All right, well, thanks again, and yeah, we'll catch you soon.
Absolutely, thanks again.
Welcome back. Still some big relegation dogfight six-pointers on the slate in the last couple of rounds of the J1 season, but arguably the biggest remaining six-pointer to be played took place after the Levine Cup final on Saturday at Nihon Daira, Johnny. It was arguably the biggest Shizuoka derby we've seen in the last 10 or 15 years. And I guess in keeping with the Levine Cup final, there was some late drama at Shimizu's home game against Jubilo Iwata. And once again, the S-Pulse faithful went home feeling frustrated.
Yes, speaking from the Gamba side of my personality, I can definitely relate to what S-Pulse have been going through recently. I think that's seven games this season. I think the stat was that they've conceded goals in additional time. You know, the fans, if they're only winning by a goal or drawing going into additional time, their hearts must be in their mouths. I think what one thing I did want to say about both sets of fans, because, you know, Dan was talking about the National Stadium is this big, huge bowl, and the fans do their best to fill it and make it very colourful. But Shimizu have got a proper old school ground, which is really designed for this kind of occasion. It was great to see the contrast that the tifos both teams had. You had the orange of Shimizu, you had the Saxon blue of Jubilo. So just kind of watching the highlights. I always like watching a game at Shimizu. It's a stadium I'd love to visit. But yeah, I thought that the fans deserved a shout out for really helping to make the occasion. The game on the pitch seemed to sometimes live up to, and at other times maybe kind of drift a bit.
Yeah, here. Nihon Daira is definitely on my bucket list. And a terrific turnout, obviously, at Nihon Daira, and both sets of supporters did their utmost to cheer their boys on. It was the Iwata keeper, Ryuki Miura, who was by far the busier, well, pretty much throughout the game, but especially in the first half hour. He made some big saves, the first of them in the very first minute of the game, while Thiago Santana headed just wide in the 20th minute. But there was nothing Miura could do about Santana putting Shimizu ahead in the 34th minute. A corner was headed on at the near post and then bundled back towards goal, where Santana was unmarked. He controlled on his thigh before blasting high into the net from 2 yards out. So Iwata were forced to play catch up again, and we wondered whether Shimizu could hold on yet again. It's the fourth straight game they have led in, but once again they were pegged back, and in those four games they only have 2 points to show for their exertions. Rio Germain came off the bench just before the hour, and he was to have the final say in the 92nd minute. He controlled a cutback and lashed in a volley at Shuichi Gonda's near post to send the Iwata supporters home happy and to basically keep their season alive, Johnny. Of course, they'd done so well to beat the leaders Yokohama F. Marinos in their previous game, and obviously to do it at the home of their fiercest rivals, and hit their own bid for safety will have really pleased the Iwata supporters. But at the end of the day, it looks like they're going to pay Iwata for that failure not to kill the game against Kashima when they were 3-1 up. And I guess they got a taste of their own medicine when Everaldo scored that late equaliser in match day 32, because how precious those extra 2 points would be for Iwata at the moment.
I guess that's probably the story for, you're looking at the bottom three now, you've got Shimizu, Gamba, Iwata. There's a tale of like good performances ruined by one mistake, late goals conceded, falling behind early on. This year, I think the G League is pretty tight. Like, if you look up to teams like, you know, 10th, 9th, 10th, 11th, I don't think there's a great deal of difference between them and 16th, 17th, 18th. It's just those lapses in concentration, isn't it? A failure to take one chance and then you're giving away a silly goal. That's the difference, really. I think a draw here, if we're honest, doesn't really do either side many favours. It slightly favours Shimizu because they've now crept above Gamba on goal difference. Mm. But yeah, if you look at Shimizu's last two fixtures at home to Jubilo, although a derby, it really is the biggest open goal you're going to get bottom of the league. And Jubilo, we've checked in the green room and we think we're correct that they basically have to win their two remaining fixtures after this. I think they've just left it too late. You know, you mentioned they won away to Mariners, they've drawn here. I've kind of been researching because they're away to Gamba. They've got another away game this weekend. And kind of between April and the end of September, so 6 months, Jubilo had 11 away games in the league. They scored 3 goals. I mean, the amount of damage that was done in that kind of 11 game run, it's almost irreparable now. So, I mean, this was the start. It seemed like it was all Shimizu. The end was absolute madness after the goal. There's chances at both ends. Both teams will think that they should have won it. Both sides will definitely have left the game, I think, a bit dissatisfied once all the tension died down. And I know you were joking about Sam at the start. I think Shimizu, I feel kind of confident, will not finish in the bottom two. And if they were to stay in that 16th spot, I know last time I was on, I said Oita would probably win the playoffs. One of my kind of rules of thumb is teams who sneak into the playoffs in the last day are always worth a bet, which is Yamagata this year. Mm. But Yamagata's main forward is Disaro, who's on loan from Shimizu, which would be a massive boost for them if he couldn't play against him. So I feel, I don't want to curse you Shimizu fans, but I think Shimizu will probably just about be a J1 club next year. Jubilo, I'm afraid, obviously as a Gamba fan, I hope the curtain comes down this week, but if it doesn't come down this week, I think it's going to end in relegation, which, as we kind of talked about with Dan, if they're not going to sign new players, then, you know, next season could get a bit embarrassing if they're having to rely on players that weren't quite cutting it this year, allied with players who've been alone to like third division clubs this year. So it's probably realistic, if they don't get their case overturned at the CAS, that Jubilo are probably better equipped to cope with J2 next season rather than J1. What about you, Ben? Do you agree with that? Is there anything you think Shimizu are doomed, or what do you think?
Well, it's very hard to have any sort of confidence in them, isn't it, Johnny? Yeah. As I said, yeah, the last four games they've led, but they haven't been able to hang on and win any of them. Indeed, they've not won in 5 games in total, ahead of hosting Kashima on Saturday and then travelling to Sapporo on the final day, where, I mean, they could lose that 6 or 7-3, couldn't they? I mean, the way Sapporo have been going about things pretty much all season. Yeah, it's really hard to have a lot of confidence in them. They just seem to be deer in the headlights once they take the lead in games. And it's a very, very delicate situation for S-Pulse. And I certainly wouldn't be putting any money on them finishing any higher than 16th. But yeah, 16th might just about be good enough for them. And they can maybe take their chances in the promotion relegation playoff. I tell you what, Johnny, before we move on, I did want to mention, I'm glad you brought it up, the chances that at either end after Rio Germain's equaliser. I mean, yeah, Thiago Santana almost got his second, of course, extending his lead in the Golden Boot race with his 13th of the season, the opener in this game. And then he skimmed the bar with a terrific shot from the edge of the area. Obviously later on in stoppage time. And then Yosuke Furukawa, who was Iwata's hero in the win against the F Marinos, he shot wide before getting absolutely clattered by an S-Pulse defender. I just wonder, Johnny, I mean, obviously this is something you do see a lot of, players being brought down after a shot has gone wide or been saved, and you know the referee just allows play to go on or tells them to get up. I mean, if this was a pass, in midfield and Furukawa had played the ball and then gotten cleaned out in the way he did. I mean, I don't think there's any dispute that he would have gotten a free kick, right? And perhaps even the opponent might have gotten a yellow card. But for some reason, the same kind of thing doesn't apply in the box, does it? Once a player has taken a shot and the ball has either gone out of play or being claimed by the keeper. I guess I'm not really suggesting that Iwata should have had a penalty there, but in some respects, I kind of am, because he was definitely cleaned out.
I think that I'd agree with what you said there. That the only two things I would add is it only appeared like Furukawa was the only one kind of protesting. And as one of the youngest players in the team, like, he really needed an Endo or a Kosuke Yamamoto to back him up. So I think it's much harder for a referee to argue and tell you, sorry, Mr. Endo, you don't know the rules, than it is to just kind of wave away an 18 or 19-year-old complaining. So I think... Yeah, that didn't really help them. And then the play just generally continued up the other end. I think you mentioned Santana. Didn't that come that there was a breakaway up the other end? I think one of the Santana chances happened then. I think the other aspect from that is, while I agree with your point, one thing that's kind of been kind of bugging me slightly about refereeing is the idea of consistency. I think that decision, harsh as it might be, I think that would be consistently given. Like, I've never seen that given as a penalty, whereas you see it given as a free kick. It's a bit like, you know, these ones where there's a shot and the ball goes in and there's a player that's kind of in the goalkeeper's line, but the line of eyesight, but it's not really interfering and the goalkeeper wouldn't have saved it anyway. But they are harsh, but they're consistently given. I think you can deal with that. Whereas you've seen other ones where, like, someone connects with another player's waist. And one instance it's a yellow card, and one instance it's a red card, and one instance it's nothing. I think fans struggle to deal with that, players struggle to deal with that, but harsh but consistent rulings, I think it's a bit easier to deal with. And it didn't really stop Furukawa. I think he should have scored. He absolutely should have scored. And the late tackle, painful as it was, I think it's probably in the cold light of day, it's not as painful as him missing his chance to be the hero again, because he set up Jermaine, so he's got a goal and an assist in the last two games. Should have been two goals and they should have still been in it. But yeah, I agree with what you say, but I think Jubilo can't really complain too much at the end of the day.
No, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, as I say, they're just simply never given, and sometimes I wonder why they're not. So at the end of the day, it was a bit like kissing your sister for both Shizuoka clubs. They both had to settle for a point, and as you say, Johnny, it does take S-Pulse above Gumba on goal difference, but yes, it could have taken them, a win would have taken them above. Indeed, the three teams are directly above them now, Fukuoka, Kyoto and Shonan, with the two games to go. So let's move on to what's coming up on Saturday then. All nine games in match day 33 will kick off at 3 p.m. And once again, Yokohama F. Marinos have the chance to wrap up the J1 title. They are 2 points and a fair whack of goal difference ahead of Kawasaki. If F. Marinos beat Urawa at home, they will be champions. If Kawasaki fail to beat Kobe at Todoroki. Of course, in this league, you expect the unexpected. So by 5 p.m. on Saturday, Kawasaki might be on top of the table, Johnny, if they beat Kobe and Reds do them a massive solid by beating F. Marinos at the Nissan Stadium. The top two, as Dan said, it does look like it's going to go down to the final day. I guess you'd expect both of them to hold serve at home. But Reds and Kobe, I'm sure, would both love to play spoilers for their direct opponents on Saturday. So, I mean, I won't pin you down for a prediction, Johnny, but they do both shape as fascinating encounters, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I've actually been thinking that the most J-League thing to happen would be for Frontale to win and Marinos lose, but then Frontale to lose the following week and Marinos come back and win. I think that would be great for the neutrals, but I don't think Frontale or Marinos fans, it would do much for their blood pressure. I think that the Marinos-Urawa game is really fascinating, because I think that the last time I was on, I was talking to you and Sam about, they'd just been hammered at Hiroshima, where they kept losing the ball near their own box, which is exactly what happened last year when they went to Marinos and lost 3-0. But then you'll also remember this season that Marinos were 3-0 up away to Urawa, and Urawa came roaring back, got 3-3 and probably should have won that game at the end. So what is very interesting is Marinos have lost home to Gamba and Jubilo, and I know as a Gamba fan that like people kind of saying Gamba are too defensive, or it's like it's anti-football or whatever. But Marinos, whether they like to admit it or not, have a problem against that kind of team just sitting in, whereas Reds are not going to do that. So this is a completely different game. Reds basically have nothing to play for other than pride, and also to show themselves, to show the supporters, and to show everyone that, you know, that they might be, what are they, 18 points off Marinos, but they want to show everyone we're coming for you next season. That this year hasn't worked, but we're the real deal. We're coming back next year. So I think, although they've got nothing to play for in terms of points or anything really, I think it's a big game for them to kind of make a statement. And Marinos, I think, will enjoy the extra space or the extra opportunities to potentially win the ball high up the field that just haven't really been there against the packed defences of Gamba and Jubilo. So I'm sorry if I ruin this for anyone who's got a ticket and it ends up 0-0, but I will go on record and say I think there'll be quite a few goals in this game. It could go either way. I have no idea which way. Frontale Kobe. Again, Kobe, the first half of the season, they just couldn't catch a break. Refereeing decisions, injuries, the bounce of the ball. But recently, they're on fire and everything's going on and off the field. But now they're officially safe and Frontale have something to play for. I'd have to, if I had to pick, I'd say a narrow Frontale win. But I think, you know, a draw or an away win remain very viable outcomes. You know, Frontale were 2-0 up against Kyoto, then Kyoto got it back to 2-1 and they're a bit nervy against a Kobe with the players like Muto and Osako. That's 2-2. Both Frontale and Marinos could easily drop points here. It's going to be a fascinating afternoon, kicking off at the same time, all games together. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. What about you, Ben? Do you have any thoughts on those big two games?
Well, yeah, I mean, Kobe, obviously, in terms of results, the hottest team in the league. They'd obviously only won 6 of their first 27 games. They've now won 5 on the spin to, as you say, Johnny, secure their safety with 2 games left when it looks like that it looked like they were going to be in a scrap for relegation right down to the wire. So, all the pressure's off them now. But, the neutral hopes that they can go to Todoroki and, properly put on a display that we were expecting them to do from the start of the season. You mentioned Muto and Osako, of course, the J-Talk player of the season from Vissel Kobe, Koya Uruki. Don't forget about him. He'll be up for putting on a big display himself. And the Reds' visit to F. Marinos looks absolutely fascinating. Doubts continue to swirl about Ricardo Rodriguez's future, whether it's confirmed behind the scenes at Reds, whether he's going to be staying on or not. I don't know. If there's any doubt amongst the head honchos there, he could go a long way towards convincing them that he is the right man for the job long term by winning away at the Nissan Stadium. And as you say, cutting into that 18-point gap that they currently trail F. Marinos by. But we'll wait and see. As we said, the title could be decided on Saturday, or we could have different leaders by 5 o'clock on Saturday. So we mentioned the fixtures for Hiroshima and Cerezo Osaka in the battle for third. Yes, I know, listeners, that technically FC Tokyo could finish third, but that's not going to happen. So I will not hear another word said about it. So all we have to do, by the way, Tokyo travel to Nagoya in basically the only game of the round that has nothing riding on it. So the dogfight is obviously where it's at, apart from the top two, Johnny. So it doesn't get any bigger. We've obviously just seen the Shizuoka Derby, but from this point on, Gamba in 17th hosting 18th placed Iwata. It's the last saloon time for Iwata, no question about that. But Gamba, if results go for them, they could be out of the relegation zone altogether by 5 o'clock on Saturday, Johnny. How are the boys getting ready, do you think? Are they relishing an occasion like this, or after such a difficult season, do you think there'll be some trepidation amongst the ranks?
I'd rather play this game away from home, to be honest. They've had so many bad results at home. And I'm very interested to see how these teams line up, because, you know, you saw both of these teams, that one of the most recent games has been against Marinos, and they've gone away and they've defended in numbers and they've actually done a good job. But Jubilo have to win so that they can't basically just sit back like they did against Marinos. Gamba, although they can technically afford a slip up if other results go their way, like I mentioned with Shimizu, this is their big chance. It's home to bottom of the league. If you can't win this game, do you really deserve to be a J1 club? Probably not. So you're probably going to have two teams that don't really want to be on the front foot, trying to go on the front foot. And added into that mix, you also have Yasuhito Endo going back to Gamba for the first time as an opposition player. He's obviously played against Gamba for Jubilo at home earlier in the season. And I think the Rikia Uehara got suspended last weekend, so Endo is probably going to start. So hopefully for Gamba perspective, he's not the man to put the knife in. But yeah, this one could go either way. Both teams very flaky. If a team is 1-0 up going into injury time, expect them to draw or lose 2-1. It's not going to be as beautiful a game maybe as Marino's Reds, but yeah, if you're into that kind of sheer terror, sheer drama, biting your nails down to the, as I do, bite the nails down to the skin, then yeah, that's the game for you. I mean, you don't really have any stick in the fire, but how do you see that one going?
Well, yeah, I mean, Iwata have got to go for it. I mean, I could see them playing spoilers and maybe nicking a draw late on again, just because they've got a happy knack of doing that, Johnny. It would obviously be devastating for Gamba if they were to take the lead and suffer a similar fate to Shimizu on Saturday. But yeah, we've seen Iwata do this consistently throughout the season. They obviously haven't won enough games to sit any higher than bottom, but They've frustrated teams so many times throughout the season by nicking points at the death. And I mean, yeah, all Gamba supporters, how would they feel if they were 1-0 up with 3 minutes to go and Yasuhito Endo was standing over a free kick to 25 yards from goal? I mean, it would be just the stuff of nightmares. So I think, well, all the pressure is on Gamba, and as you say, they haven't performed well at home this season. And fingers crossed for you. But you're right. If they don't win this game, then yeah, it could be all over for them. If other results that we're going to come on to now, if they go against Gamba, then it could be curtains for them as well. So Shimizu host Kashima. We've mentioned that Antlers have not won in 7. Shimizu not won in 5. So well, you'd hope for Shimizu's sake that they could keep their survival hopes alive and before they head to Sapporo in match day 34. The three teams immediately out of the drop zone are Fukuoka host Kashiwa, who have of course been rudderless sputtering to the finish line after the heights they hit earlier on in the season. Kyoto host a Kansai derby against Cerezo Osaka, who will be licking their wounds after their Levain Cup final, but of course still could finish third themselves. But you'd like to think this game means a little bit more for Kyoto than it does for their visitors, while Shonan are also at home. They host Sagan Tosu, who are 9th in the table. Belmare, they've only got one win in the last couple of months, so I don't know how confident they could be heading into this, but they are the best placed of the bottom six at the moment, a point clear of Kyoto and Fukuoka, and two clear of Shimizu and Gamba. I guess we should mention Sapporo, Johnny. They're technically, mathematically not safe yet. They travel to Hiroshima this weekend before hosting Shimizu on the final day. But a point from either of those games would lock up Sapporo's survival. So what of Fukuoka, Kyoto and Shonan then? They're all at home and they all look reasonably winnable fixtures, but yes, this is J1, this is the J League, so I'm sure nothing will go to plan for those three teams either. But I don't know, maybe the most likely of those three teams to win, which one would you plump for?
Well, the last time I was on, I said Kyoto at home to Nagoya. That looked like the struggling team most likely to win, and they could only draw 1-1. And you had Gamba going away to win at Marinos and things like that going on. So I'm very cautious. The problem all of these teams have is that if Gamba win and Shimizu win, then a draw is not really good enough. And I could quite easily see all of these teams drawing. Like, I can see Fukuoka playing quite well, but Fukuoka and Shonan have the problem of not scoring enough goals. So playing well and drawing 0-0 isn't necessarily a good result. If Gamba lose and Shimizu lose, it's fine. I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case. I think, yeah, Fukuoka have it in them to grind out a 1-0 win over Kashiwa. Whether they actually do it is another matter. Shonan, again, because I think Machino missed their last game, but there's been a bit of time since then. And they've got someone like Hiroyuki Abe who can always pull out a bit of magic. But then again, Sagan are the kind of team you think, you know, they rocked up to Gamba and won 3-0 without breaking sweat. You think they're in the same boat as these teams that are just cruising. I could see Shonan drawing 0-0 with Tosu. Fukuoka, I could also see drawing with Kashiwa. I've just got this feeling Cerezo, because it's kind of a derby, they'll have a big support and it's just after the cup. I don't think that's an easy game for Kyoto, especially because they're so high up in the league. It's not like sort of, you know, Sagan are ninth. They're 9 points behind Cerezo. So Cerezo are a good bit better than that kind of opposition. I think Kyoto actually have the hardest game.
Right.
But all three of these, especially Shonan and Fukuoka, fit the category of winnable, but also very losable. Would you go along with that?
Yeah. I mean, well, obviously they're all down there for a reason, but they do look good. The sort of games you'd want on paper at this time of the season. Obviously, Kyoto's on paper it looks the hardest, but at the same time, the Sanga players will certainly be ready for this, I'm sure. Chalkwe J will have them raring to go from kickoff, and they'll hope to maybe jump Cerezo, who will be still a bit groggy after that beating they took in stoppage time at the hands of Hiroshima. So I don't think we should do prediction, should we, Johnny? I mean, the last time you were on, I suggested that Kyoto, Kobe were going to go down, and then they're on a run of five straight wins. So I'm certainly not going to put my foot in my mouth again. But they all look fascinating in their own right, and may the chips fall where they may. And it's going to be a fascinating Saturday afternoon at both ends of the table. Obviously, and as I said, fingers crossed for you and for Gamba. Let's hope they can turn on a display at home. Well, I mean, first and foremost, win the game, and if they do it in some sort of style, that would be a happy bonus for you, I'm sure. So a huge match day ahead on Saturday, and all that's left for us to do, Johnny, is I guess to rubber stamp a few players of the season, as our patrons have voted on another five clubs over the course of the last few days, and almost all of them were bordering on landslides. Landslide results. We've mentioned with Dan at the end of part one, Dialton was a clear winner of the FC Tokyo poll. I was happy to go along with that, and I imagine that you would be as well.
Yeah, obviously you guys have watched a lot more FC Tokyo than me. I think Dialton, he always seems to play well against Gamba. I don't know how he does against other teams, and probably what the FC Tokyo fans, one of the biggest problems has been a kind of lack of consistency. It seems like FC Tokyo either win a game easily or lose a game easily. So I'm not really sure what's going on there. I'm sure, Albert, we haven't looked at that over the winter. I think that the one player I wanted to just mention was Kuryu Matsuki, because, you know, he's kind of fallen away a bit. But if you look at it, I believe he won the All Japan High School Championship. It was either the same day or it was one day before FC Tokyo's like 2022 season kickoff event. So he's basically gone from that to just becoming a professional footballer and getting called up to all manner of kind of national teams over the spring and summer. So I think for him, because the season's finishing a bit early, a well-earned rest for him. And then I think he'll come back rearing to go next year. But yeah, I've got no issue with Adelton comfortably walking away with the Player of the Season award.
Yeah, fair enough then. And Matsuki, I mean, obviously huge raps on him coming in, and a year of professional experience under his belt. He basically walked straight into the team and has been almost ever present. So very few 18-year-olds get to do that in J League clubs, and he's proven that he belongs at this level, and Tokyo supporters hoping that he can really kick on in year two for as long as we've got him. Anyway, he's obviously very ambitious young man, and has his sights set elsewhere, I think, eventually. But obviously no question about his commitment to the Tokyo cause this season. Speaking of FC Tokyo, I did mention there was a question from Alex Bishop. It's on one of our old favourites. That's definitely in inverted commas. Keigo Higashi. Alex wonders, after 10 long years at the club, have FC Tokyo finally found Keigo Higashi's best position? Basically, Albert Pucci just decided to stick him at the base of the midfield, Johnny, and where he can have the least amount of damage on the Tokyo attack, I think, because things tend to stall in the final third when Keigo's involved. But he has proven a dab hand at holding midfield. At least he always seems to be guaranteed a game. So I guess this is the place in the starting 11 where he can cause the least damage to the Tokyo attack. Anyway, Alex mentions a killer stat that this season Tokyo have won 54.5% of the games Keigo has played in, and just a 20% of the games he hasn't. So Alex picking and choosing his numbers there, but fair dues. I mean, it's in some respects a reclamation project, and there are obviously Tokyo supporters who rate Higashi and always have done. So they'll be pleased to see him getting a little bit more recognition. As it's well known on this podcast, he's not my cup of tea, but he has at least acquitted himself well in this new position. Kudos to him, and kudos to Albert Pucci for trying it out, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there's always players that you see and they just play season after season. You wonder how they managed to do it. Like, why is this guy getting picked? But he's obviously doing something right, because Albert is by no means the first coach to regularly choose him in his team. And it's an FC Tokyo team that finish in the top half of J1 pretty much every season. So, you know, he is an established top half player who seems to be quite respected among his peers and among opposition players. And just kind of like looking ahead, because I think Alex's question is about like next year, because I think Tokyo have been one of the most active teams in kind of like already like promoting youngsters from the youth system and kind of contracting players from university and high schools. And they've got a young player, Tsubasa Terayama, coming in from Juntendo University, who I believe came up through the FC Tokyo youth system and played a few games with under-23s and J3. Mm-hmm. And his profile seems to fit that of, he'd be someone to go in the middle, potentially in his first year, maybe not the first day like Matsuki, but I think he might be someone that they're looking at. And there's also like three other players. I think one player, Nishido from Waseda, and there's Tawara Tsumida, I believe his name is, from FC Tokyo under-18s, and Yuta Arai from Shohei High School. Mm. They all play wide midfield and central midfield. I'm not sure which is actually their favoured position, but all these guys are young players, are all like 22 and younger. So with Albert in charge, I think, you know, people like Higashi, if it's not next season, it's the season after that they really start getting phased out. So I think, yeah, all credit to Albert for getting a new position, for finding new joy with him. But I think the longer Albert stays at the club, I think the younger a team FC Tokyo become. That's my outside view. Do you think, is that how you're feeling as a Tokyo supporter?
Well, yeah, you'd like to hope so. And you'd like to hope that Albert and his staff have had a lot of input into the sort of players that the club will be bringing in. And there is definitely a need for a clean out. I've been banging that drum for a number of years now. I appreciate you can't just get rid of 15, 20 players all in one go, even though at times I certainly would have liked the club to have done that. But the first things first is you can see that Albert will give young players a chance if they're good enough, and if they prove in preseason that they deserve a chance. So let's hope that a more exciting and progressive FC Tokyo, and more consistent for me is obviously the most important, which I appreciate is not always a given with young players and giving them a chance. But I guess I can't have my cake and eat it too. But a bit of a refresh in the Tokyo squad over the winter, and they can attack the start of next season. All right, so well done to Adailton. He has retained his crown as FC Tokyo player of the season for Cerezo Osaka. Obviously heartbroken after Saturday's Levain Cup final loss. There is some joy though for Hiroaki Okuno, who got 66% of the 15 votes cast by our patrons in the Cerezo poll. He was streets clear of Riku Matsuda and Seiya Maekuma. I'm surprised to see Okuno win by such a margin, Johnny, but I can't argue with the overall decision. He's proven himself to be a very consistent part of the Cerezo midfield.
Yeah, I think it's difficult with Cerezo because they're clearly a very good team, judging by their league and cup performances. But it's difficult to, like, in this we're picking out individuals, that they're a team. And I think no one really epitomises that more than Okuno, who, you know, remember he played up front for the team under Lotina, and he's now back in his regular role in central midfield. And obviously now Yuki Fujita left for Tosu last season, which left him with more kind of defensive duties alongside, like, first Harakawa and then Suzuki. And yeah, he's just, you mentioned consistency with FC Tokyo. Okuno is Mr. Consistency. It's rare to see him have a bad game. He's really someone who continues to grow even at 33. You still feel that there's more in his game. He gets better every year. But I think, kind of, as I mentioned with Cerezo a little bit in, when we're talking about them in the Levain Cup final, you know, we talked about them before, me, you and Sam, about how they tend to have a very good season, but then they follow up with a terrible drop off sometimes into J2. I think they've got a good manager in Kogiku. They've got a good young squad. They're finding these gems that other teams can't find or don't want to find in J2. And they've got experienced players like Okuno, Kim, Kiyotake, Jonic. There's really no reason, like, Cerezo fans, Cerezo players, Cerezo coaching staff, they need to be looking, I'd say, within the next 2 to 3 years at putting in a genuine title chance. There's no use just falling away and finishing like 15th again and then kind of coming back in a couple of years. I think this is their time. There's no excuse that they should, that they're a big enough team, they've got good enough players, that they should be challenging for top spot within the next two or three years. And that's coming from a Gamba fan saying that. You know, do you rate the kind of squad or potential as high as me, Ben, or do you think that's maybe a bit of overreach? Or?
Well, no. I mean, you mentioned before when we were talking about the final how much progress both Hiroshima and Cerezo have made this season, working their way up the table. And yet Cerezo are legitimately fourth and, yeah, have deserved their spot that high in the table. I think they've taken a lot of people by surprise. But, again, they have some terrific youngsters coming through, obviously, and a balanced squad that enabled them to withstand so many, niggling injuries or in some cases significant injuries that would have hampered lesser clubs, I think. And Kogiku definitely deserves a mention. Some wondered whether he would get the job permanently, and he's very much justified the faith that the club placed in him. And I guess, yeah, they're so many times in the past, haven't they? They've been guilty of false starts, as you said, and we'll wait and see whether they can properly kick on from this. I think they'll definitely have to prove themselves all over again at the start of next season, but they have the players to do it, I think. So, Hiroaki Okuno, a deserving winner. A pop quiz, Johnny. You don't happen to recall who won the J-Talk Player of the Season for Cerezo last season, do you? Hate to put you on the spot, but it was a name that I was surprised to recall, actually. It's not the likes of Hiroshi Kiyotaka, who you might have been expecting.
Yeah, that was exactly the name that was in my head. Maruhashi, maybe?
No longer at the club. Tatsuhiro Sakamoto was the pick. Yeah. Yes, remember him?
Yes, but vaguely.
Yes. He was a terrific player for them, but obviously now playing his trade abroad. Sorry, that's the last of my random questions without notice for this episode, Johnny. And next we'll move on to Hiroshima. And, this was the most clear-cut of all of the polls so far, I believe. Mind you, I can't remember the numbers from last week, but there was never any doubt that Makoto Mitsuta would win the Hiroshima poll. There were 17 votes cast, and it would have been 18, but Stephen Packer missed the closing time of the poll. So Mitsuta got 12, but we're going to give him 13 because Stephen's vote can count at the end of the day as well. Miles clear of Tsukasa Morishima, who's obviously had a terrific season as well, but Mitsuta is getting some buzz for not just player of the season for Hiroshima, but player of the year in J1. I'm not sure he'll actually end up getting that accolade, Johnny. Obviously, the J-League usually likes to reward a player from the champion team. So we'll wait and see which team wins the league, of course, before we have to cross that bridge. But yeah, Mitsuta, there can be no denying the impact he's had on the league. And there was never any question he was going to win this award, was there?
Yes, it's difficult actually to think of new words to say, because I think the last two appearances I've had, he's had fantastic performances, and yeah, he's the breakout star of 2022. And I know he missed that penalty against Kofu in the Emperor's Cup final, but the fact that he took the fifth penalty, as Sam said in the penalty shootout, tells a lot about his character. Like, anyone can miss a penalty, not everyone can stand up and bury a penalty like he did under that pressure like 5 minutes later. So I think that tells you a lot about him. I think, unfortunately, for fans of the league, and especially Sam Fritchie, this time next year he's probably not going to be playing in the J-League. Whereas Tsukasa Morishima, it's actually quite interesting, because you know there's a kind of profile that players fit into that before they head off to Europe. I think if he's still with Sam Fritchie this time next year, I think he's there. He's a lifer. I think it's this winter or next summer, or else he'll sort of be too old to go to Europe. But I kind of have that feeling, a bit like Tomoki Iwata at Marinos. It's that once you go back to 26, I don't think European clubs are too interested. But yeah, again, he's a fantastic season. The other two, Kashiwa, I remember at the start of the season, we were talking about skippers Gegen pressing, and Aoyama and Kashiwa were two, I think, Sam singled out as they're not going to be able to do it. And Kashiwa's proved us all wrong. He's been fine. He's been great. And Shiotani, again, culpable against Kofu, but I think that's been a mere blip in what's been a pretty triumphant return to J-League from him. So yeah, all of these guys have had a great season, but Mitsuta, yeah, I think, yeah, I don't think you or I or anyone could really doubt that he's been the star of the show.
No, most definitely. I mean, fair play to the patrons that voted for Morishima, and indeed, two other votes were cast for the other nominees. But Mitsuta, a runaway winner of that poll, and indeed of the Hiroshima Player of the Season award. Winning by not quite as big a margin, but definitely a clear-cut winner amongst the Kawasaki poll. Again, 15 votes cast by our patrons. Akihiro Iyanaga was the clear winner ahead of Marcinho. Johnny, Iyanaga is still in with a chance for his first ever J1 Golden Boot. He has 11 goals. He's two behind Thiago Santana with the two games to play. But Marcinho, if he hits a purple patch in the final two match days, he could win it himself. He's just a goal further back on 10. We could talk about the overall standard of the strikers in the league, the fact that 13 leads the league with only two rounds to go, but we'll park that for another time. And I don't know, do you want to stir up any controversy here by going into bat for Marcinho, or do you think Iyanaga is the right choice?
I'd say Iyanaga's the right choice, but winning by 27% is quite harsh on Marcinho, because I think, you know, you've got Iyanaga down the right, Marcinho down the left. And again, as you and Sam have said, they're so different as players. It's almost like, you know, like baseball or cricket, like constantly changing between facing a right-hander and left-hander. The styles are so different, it really unbalances and unsettles defences. And, you know, if I can again shoehorn a slight Gamba reference in, it was announced today that the club are changing from Umbro to Hummel shirts from next year. So they had old pictures of teams wearing the Umbro uniform. And I was looking through 2004. I said, that's not Akihiro Iyanaga, is it? And it was. 2004, he was in the Gamba team. He's had a very up and down career, lots of ups recently. And, you know, if he scores one more goal, that's the highest total in his career in any division, even his times in J2. And at 36, yes. Showed no sign of letting up. So, yeah, it's a fantastic season. Marcinho, again, there's rumours he might leave at the end of the year. I hope not, because, yeah, he's really come into his own. And I think, again, sort of steering clear of the quality of strikers argument, but I think the league really needs good quality foreign players at the minute. It's been tough over the COVID period. And he is that. He's a good quality, exciting player. So maybe not quite enough to unseat Iyanaga, but I think, yeah, if there was a less percent between the first and second, I'd be happy with that. Are you happy to go along with that, Ben?
Yeah, I was quite surprised at the gap between the two, as I think Marcinho at times has been Kawasaki's most important player in stages throughout the season. But yeah, I mean Iwanaga, he just does it week in week out, and a phenomenal player at 36, as you say, Johnny, is tremendous that he's still able to play at such a high level on such a consistent basis. So yeah, we'll give it to Iwanaga with a silver medal for Marcinho, and again, he could still win the Golden Boot. He could be the man that delivers the title to Frontale. Who knows over the course of the final two match days? But if Frontale are going to do it, I imagine these two will be front and center, no question. Well, hoping to deny Frontale a third straight title, of course, are Yokohama F. Marinos, and they are the final poll that will run through on this episode. It ended Monday evening, Japan time, and it was the closest of the five that we ran this week, Johnny. I don't know whether our patrons got polled out this week, a little bit of fatigue or not, but I was expecting a boatload of votes in this one. It actually got the fewest of the five. Obviously, our patrons might have been busy on a Sunday afternoon and their minds might have been elsewhere. I completely understand, of course. But yeah, only 12 votes cast in this poll. And as I say, it was the closest of the five. Takuma Nishimura got 6 votes, and Kota Mizunuma was the closest to him with 4. Sorry, it was 13 votes, wasn't it? And Takuya Kida and Elber also getting some consideration. But the top two were left to battle it out. Johnny, obviously, at the start of the season, Nishimura would have been nobody's a predicted F. Marinos player of the season list, but he's been absolutely tremendous for them since arriving from Sendai, and Mizunuma as well has been hugely influential. So a very difficult one to choose, and it shows in how close it was for our patrons. Which way of these between these two would you lean yourself?
Well, I'd have to probably back the patrons, because I think, like, if you had an option, all of the above, that'd be a very viable choice to win. And Marinos are one of the few teams which probably shows their strength in the top of the league, that all four of the names have genuine, like, shouts to win. And you've even got someone like Tomoki Iwata, who didn't make the list, that you could probably make a claim for, which shows the amount of people who have contributed to their success, which probably shows that the league this year, there's been a lot of good and very good performances, but maybe few outstanding ones that we've seen in recent years. Again, perhaps that the loss of players to Europe and the difficulty like the teams have had of attracting new players maybe from overseas have hit that. Yeah, I think the one player I would shout out is Elber, who I think is he's so far off the pace of winning it, but you know, he's the one that started the most games. 5 goals, 5 assists. He's very consistent. He contributes a lot. Mizunuma, yeah, again, another like Okuno and Iwanaga. He's another one who just seems to age gracefully, and he's still doing it. I thought when he left Cerezo to Marinos, he was kind of giving up his starting berth, but he's won it back, and he's been a key player. But I just edge with Nishimura. Getting Marcos Jr. out of the starting lineup is no easy task. And, you know, 9 goals and 19 starts. He's really been a revelation, completely wasted by Sendai when he was back there. I don't know why he couldn't play more regularly than he did. Whenever he came on, he changed things. I don't know what was going on off the field or what the reason was. But, you know, Marinos have seen something that no one else did. And they've taken full advantage and reaped the rewards. And they deserve all the credit in the world for that. So, the strong claims from Mizunuma, again, Takuya Kida, just listen to an old episode with Sam talking about him, you'll know how good he is. Elber, underrated, under the radar consistency, but for me, just Nishimura, I'll go with the patron. So what about you?
Yeah, I won't rock the boat here. I think it's a very close call. But yeah, I mean, Nishimura's overall impact this season has been tremendous. And yeah, nudging double figures. Again, we certainly didn't see that coming. A wasted a wasted time at the end of the day at Sendai for him. They, well, wasted on their part, as you say, they didn't make the most of having him there. We again, we don't know what went on behind the scenes, but yeah, he's flourished when, again, you might remember right back at the start of the season, we talked about the players that had left the relegated clubs, and we talked about Sendai, and I didn't even mention Nishimura joining F Marinos, because I just thought he was going to be another face in the crowd amongst F Marinos' array of attacking weapons. I wondered what sort of opportunities he would get, if many at all. I thought, yeah, he would be one of the last cabs off the rank, but at times this season he's been indispensable, and again, it's great to see him back at, before the end of the season, because yeah, we did worry after that nasty ankle injury at the hands of Tatsuki Nara, but yeah, he's bounced back, and he will hope to fire F Marinos to J1 glory in their final two match days. A special shout out though to my old mate Kota Mizunuma. He has had a tremendous season, and I doff my cap to him. And it's good that you mentioned Iwata as well, Johnny. I mean, we could have had five or six players in this poll, but then I guess it just becomes the votes get spread too thin. A tremendous season from so many F Marinos players that they hope will end with a J1 title, of course, either this Saturday or the following one. It's going to be a bumper match day 33 this Saturday. Thanks to our patrons for their input into the polls. Thanks to Alex for his question. Thanks to Dan Olowitz, of course, for all of his input in part one. And Johnny, thank you ever so much for, as I said at the start, pinch hitting for Sam. We wonder whether the S-Pulse bandwagon is going to be completely broken down by 5 p.m. on Saturday, or whether Sam will get it back and up and running. But we'll wait and see. For now, thanks ever so much again for joining us.
Thanks again, Ben. It's fun. As usual, it's taken much longer than we both expected to, but I hope all the listeners and all the patrons enjoy the fruits of our labor. So thank you very much.
Well, yeah, if you didn't enjoy this, listeners, you better go and listen to another podcast, I think. This has been vintage J-Talk from start to finish. And, Johnny, we, as I said, we very much appreciate you joining us again. And don't worry, we will come calling have you help Sam and I put together our J1 team of the season. No question about that. So we'll leave it there. I've already done all of my thank yous. So all that's left of me to do is to say thank you, listeners, for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 match day 33. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.